Welcome to the Town Hall Review, brought to you by the Salem Media Group. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Against the backdrop of the national heartbreak in Orlando, we'll hear from Donald Trump.
The attack was so horrible last week. And when there's attacks, sadly, because there's nothing more horrible, you don't want to get things. But people view me as a much stronger person in terms of protecting our country.
Voices politicizing the Orlando massacre are flummoxed by experts who cite the factual record.
Since 1950, with just three exceptions, every single one of the mass public shootings in the United States have taken place where general citizens aren't allowed to be able to have guns for protection.
And then finally, after 52 long years, Cleveland, yes, the big city in my hometown of northeastern Ohio, gets a big, big win.
Cleveland did not have a champion since 1964 when Jim Brown led the Browns to the title game. And that was the last time any of the major sports in Cleveland won anything.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. The heartbreaking horror from the June 12 Orlando terror attack was quickly upstaged by gun control grandstanding from those who should know better. Against this backdrop of horror, of terror, and of off-the-point debate, the presumptive party nominees, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, have sharpened their knives. The thought of where the nation had come in just a few short months can be staggering sometimes. But here we are, and the noise from both sides is getting louder as the campaign draws closer. Some 900 evangelical leaders gathered in New York on Tuesday to hear from Mr. Trump, many of them very supportive. I turned to Robert Costa of the Washington Post for his interpretation on my program. Now, let's dig into the Trump event. It was very successful. I think more than 900 people at Trump Tower in an appeal to evangelicals to get behind him under the banner of religious liberty. He announced his advisory committee, which has some very big and familiar names to those within that community, including James Dobson and Michelle Bachmann and Richard Land and Ralph Reed and Seeley Yates and a number of others. How successful an event, how successful an outreach, Robert Costa?
It was a successful event for Trump, and it was helpful to him to make sure that he has that foundation of evangelical leaders at his side. This was not something that just came about overnight. In the evangelical community, when you talk to people like Jerry Falwell Jr. and Robert Jeffers of Texas, they always argued for months during the primary that Trump was a different kind of candidate. Sure, he wasn't a natural fit with evangelicals, but because he represented wholesale change, he could change the system, and he seemed to if not identify with all of the evangelical values on a personal level, he seemed to understand the need for religious liberty. And he had a rapport with evangelical leaders. And this was the culmination, this meeting yesterday, of all of those efforts and just that kind of natural move by evangelicals to get away from a traditional candidate and to try something new. Because evangelicals, just like a lot of constituencies on the right, they want to win. And they want the White House back. And in Trump, they see someone who could do that perhaps more than any other traditional candidate.
Let me play for you a couple of the clips that we have from him yesterday. Can we play cut number 7 talking to evangelicals on Tuesday?
Anything about Hillary in terms of religion? Now, she's been in the public eye for years and years, and yet there's nothing out there. There's like nothing out there. It's going to be an extension of Obama, but it's going to be worse, because with Obama, you had your guard out. With Hillary, you don't. And it's going to be worse.
Pretty controversial, Robert Costa. Add to that this comment, cut number 9.
Christianity, I owe so much to it in so many ways, through life, through having incredible children, through so many other things. But I also owe it from, frankly, standing here, because the evangelical vote was mostly gotten by me.
So what do you make of these appeals, and are they effective, Robert Costa?
The attacks on Clinton's faith could actually turn off some voters. I haven't seen polling data on this. That's always a murky political move, difficult to make that stick. But I think Trump is right when he alludes to the fact that evangelicals feel comfortable with him. It's not an affinity and a relationship that people predicted would happen and would sustain Trump politically. But they have been some of his strongest support within his base. The thing that the evangelical community is so crucial for Trump right now is he doesn't have a national political network behind him. He's relying on the Republican National Committee for his grassroots organization. If he can get Christian voters and evangelical voters around the country to come out in an organized way, that would help him so much because he does not have the infrastructure on a lot of other levels.
Meanwhile, the yammering from the gun control politicos dominated the week on Capitol Hill, where the U.S. Senate considered and ditched three separate bills, and the House fell into theatrical chaos. Mike Gallagher turned to John R. Lott, Jr., author of the forthcoming book, The War on Guns, Arming Yourself Against Gun Control Lies.
You know, it seems like the American public really didn't have the stomach for trying to initiate all kinds of gun control laws after Sandy Hook. Again, yesterday, all four of these attempts failed. Are politicians ever going to wake up and understand that Americans do seem to recognize this ultimate quintessential slippery slope of taking away the constitutional right to keep and bear arms from American citizens?
Well, I think the main thing with the amendments that were voted on yesterday is that none of them would have actually dealt with Orlando. None of them would have dealt with any of the mass public shootings that occurred during the Obama administration or earlier. And, you know, maybe people want to do something, and I know I want to do something about these types of attacks. But let's try to deal with something that's actually been relevant in these attacks.
Break it down for us, John, and tell us why none of these amendments would have effectively dealt with what happened in Orlando.
Well, none of the mass public shootings during the Obama administration or earlier have involved people that have been on the terror watch list or the no-fly list. None of these attacks have involved people that have, that would have been relevant for these universal background checks in terms of private transfers. The thing is, there's a huge problems with the no-fly list. It sounds horrible. You know, you'd want to keep people off, but most of the people that are on that list have nothing to do with terrorism. You can get on the list simply because the government wants to talk to you or because you refuse to be an informant about for somebody else. There's no crimes that necessarily have to be committed by an individual or thought to have been committed by an individual. You don't even have to be directly related to terrorism yourself in any way to be on these lists.
Following a wild and entertaining debate season, it appears that we will soon be looking at a very consequential November election outcome. And the likely Republican nominee, Donald Trump, joined me to lay out a number of answers to questions that many of us are asking. What I'd like to do, though, rather than a usual interview, is give you some of my recommendations on how to beat Hillary and get your reactions to them.
That's
is that
okay.
good with you?
Fine.
First one, because this election is going to be about terrorism, I think you ought to name either Tom Cotton or Chris Christie as your vice president, because Cotton's, he's a senator now, but as an Army ranger, he sought out and killed terrorists, and Chris Christie prosecuted them. What do you think of those two guys?
Well, I think they're both great, and they've been very supportive. And we have a lot of support. You know, it's interesting. We have much more support than the press lets you believe, a tremendous support. And, you know, they may go and say, well, here's a rogue person from the Republican Party. And we definitely have the people's support. You see that. You even see that in the polls. We get hammered for 4 weeks unfairly by the press. And the polls are just about even. And she's spending a fortune, and I'm not. So we have a lot of support. I think we're going to do great. But I like those two guys a lot. I think they're terrific guys.
Do you think that the election will turn on terror and the ability to win that war and fight it successfully and that they would be good number twos?
Well, it depends where we are. It depends where we are in the cycle. The attack was so horrible last week. And when there's attacks, sadly, because there's nothing more horrible, you don't want to get things, but people view me as a much stronger person in terms of protecting our country.
And so would Cotton or Christie help you in that regard?
Well, I can say I can't give you any clues or anything right now because I do have a lot of respect for those two guys, but I have a lot of respect for others also. Chris came out very early and endorsed me. I've gotten very good very good statements from Senator Cotton, who is whose parents I know and met. I think that he is a very talented guy. He's also very popular. He's a very popular person. So these are two names that I have high on the list for something, at least, that I can tell you.
My second recommendation, and it's never been done before, but you've done a lot of things that have never been done before, is
that
to name a lot of your cabinet. For example, former Senator John Kyle at Defense, or former Ambassador Bolton at State, or former Senator Lieberman to run the CIA. Will you name members of your cabinet early so that the whole conservative movement and the middle of the country see a serious team that Donald Trump has put together to fight these so many serious battles we have in front of us?
Yeah. Are you talking about prior to the convention or just naming the cabinet sometime soon thereafter?
Either or both. Maybe rolling out throughout the entire election season, but before the election.
I might be inclined to do that. I don't think that's that unusual, though. That's been done before, hasn't it, you?
No, I don't think we've ever had a cabinet member named. There was a hint that Colin Powell was going to be W's Secretary of State, but it was just a hint. I mean, if you appear with these guys.
Well, did they wait till after the election and then
yes.
The cabinet? No,
really? Yes.
I would be inclined. I would think it's no great shakes. I would be inclined to do a lot of it early. You don't have to do all of it, but a lot of it early. Actually.
That is great news. I think that would really rally a lot of people to your
flag. I like that idea very much.
Third one, I think you know this. The campaign is going to come down to these three debates with Hillary Clinton and you. And I'm curious, are you practicing? I tell people that the best I've ever seen you is when you gave your UN remodel testimony to the Senate and you had it mastered. You'd obviously practiced it. Are you in full practice mode already with someone playing Hillary Clinton who will be as tough on you as she will be in these debates?
I have not. And I must tell you... I think you and I have a little different mode. I watched Romney went into a log cabin or something, and he came out, and he wouldn't talk to anybody for weeks and, you know, all of that. And then he got to the debate, and he wasn't able to speak so well. I've seen that. And, you know, to a certain extent, you have to be yourself. I do know the issues. I actually know the issues, I think, much better than people understand that I know the issues. But I will be practicing, but I don't want to put so much practice in that all of a sudden you're not who you are. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does.
And you know better than anybody, because in the debates, at least according to the online poll, and many pundits, I don't know if you're one of them, actually, but according to every single online poll, of which there are seven, I won every debate. I don't know if you agree with that, but I won every single debate.
When we return, why the November election deeply troubles a leading conservative.
I have been writing about Hillary Clinton. I just actually looked this up. Since 1998, when she was busy standing by when Suha Arafat was launching anti-Semitic tirades against Israel and the Jews. And Hillary Clinton's record in office is dreadful. Her ideas are dreadful. They will make us less safe.
When the Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The sobering reality of a November showdown between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton is just that, sobering. Following a wild and sometimes entertaining debate season, it appears that we will soon be looking at a very consequential November election outcome. Some respected conservative pundits remain deeply troubled by a Donald Trump nomination. Will they ever see it differently? Brett Stevens is a distinguished Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. Now with the Wall Street Journal, Brett formerly serves as editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post. Brett spoke candidly with me about his reservations on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Brett, if the choice is Clinton versus Trump, who is Brett Stevens going to vote for?
Probably none of the above. I will never vote for Donald Trump. I have a very, very hard time voting for Mrs. Clinton. I have been writing about Hillary Clinton. I just actually looked this up. Since 1998, when she was busy standing by when Suha Arafat was launching anti-Semitic tirades against Israel and the Jews. And Hillary Clinton's record in office is dreadful. Her ideas are dreadful. They will make us less safe. But there is no way I'm going to vote for a guy who is just totally uninformed, unpresidential, as Donald Trump is.
So he brings along, let me make an argument to you, and I look forward to reading when you think and write through this, because I think you're so influential that it will matter. He brings 3,000 people with him, a vice president, a secretary of defense, a secretary of state, a head of the national intelligence community, a CIA director, et cetera, et cetera. He can keep Joe Dunford in, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who is widely regarded as the best in a long time, et cetera, et cetera. And so we elect 3,000 people, not just one. And it seems to me that as a civilian, this is Hugh Hewitt talking, not Brett, I owe the people who are on the front end of the spear, the people on the front line, the best commander-in-chief of the two. I owe them my informed judgment as to who will do the best by America. I can't sit it out because they can't sit it out. They're taking bullets and incoming. So how do you respond to that argument about having to make the choice? And if you're obliged to make the choice upon pondering that, who would the choice be?
You're asking me the same question twice. My answer is the same. The only person who counts in the administration is the President of the United States, Hugh. That's the only person who counts. When George W. Bush decided to save the American position in Iraq by going against the advice of all of his wise men, of Jim Baker and the whole Iraq study group and 90% of his administration, that was George W. Bush's decision. So we have to bear in mind that this isn't an administration we're electing, it's a person that we are electing. Who knows better than you what it means to have a commander-in-chief who lived his entire life, who lived throughout the entire Cold War, and doesn't know what the nuclear triad is? It's absolutely astonishing. And so it's terrific to have Joe Dunfords and you know, perhaps John Boltons and other people in positions of trust, but you have to have a president who bothered over the last 70 years to gain a cursory understanding of how the world works. And on so many issues, Hugh, on so many issues, I know not all of the issues, but on so many issues, this guy is just the antithesis of what I'd want a Republican president to be on foreign policy. When it comes to trade, when it comes to standing up to countries like North Korea, when it comes to standing up to guys like Vladimir Putin, Donald Trump is not a conservative.
Brett, you don't have to. I agree with you on all of that. I know the critique. Nevertheless, what about my argument that civilians owe people who are fighting the war the best of the two candidates for commander-in-chief? We don't have the option to be conscientious objectors in the one part of the war that is part of our job, which is to pick a commander-in-chief.
Listen, I think that for the United States, Hillary Clinton, as awful as I find her, is a survivable event. I'm not so sure about Donald Trump.
Wow.
Well, and let me add one more point to that, Hugh. The United States survives so long as at least one of its major parties is politically and intellectually healthy. I don't think the Republican Party, or I should say the Republican Party as the vehicle for modern American conservative ideas, survives with Donald Trump.
In keeping with the heavy drama of these past several months, the recent National Basketball Association finals did not disappoint. It would be difficult to speak of a more fitting final. Seven games. The team that was down 3-1 heading into the fifth game ended up winning the series for the first time ever, and that game itself was in doubt to the final 30 seconds. This was, as I've said a few times this week, the greatest comeback in finals of a major sport ever. Of course, I am from Northeastern Ohio, and I'm hometowning it a little bit there, but I am not alone. I am a proud Cleveland sports fan, and I was transfixed, but I was not alone. My colleague Larry Elder, an L.A. to Cleveland transplant for 17 years, provided some great color commentary of his own on The Larry Elder Show.
I moved to Cleveland when I'm 22-ish, and I lived there for 17 years. When I first got there, the very first day I pulled up into the public parking lot, privately owned parking lot across the street from the big law firm where I worked, and I pulled up with a car with California plates. And the guy who owns the lot is named Danny. And Danny says to me, "Are you from California?" I said, "Yeah, Los Angeles." He said, "Are you here permanently?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You ain't gonna like it." My very first day. Because Cleveland did not have a champion since 1964 when Jim Brown led the Browns to the title game. And that was the last time any of the major sports in Cleveland won anything. There was the famous called the drive when I was there. John Elway playing for the Denver Broncos. The ball was on the 1 or 2 yard line. He had to go 98 yards in order to win. Had he lost that drive, had they not done so, Cleveland would have gone to the Super Bowl. We were all assuming we were going to go. And John Elway methodically drove down the field and scored. A year or so later, Cleveland was about ready to drive to tie the game, going into overtime. And if they won, it would then go into the Super Bowl. These were also home games. And Ernest Biner, the running back who had an extraordinarily good game that day, fumbled on the 1 yard line. Cleveland loses. Then there's something called the shot. By the way, these debacles are given a name. There's the drive, there's the fumble, and then there's the shot. Michael Jordan playing in Cleveland against the Cavaliers, who were about ready to go to the championship game. He lights up the Cavaliers for 60 points, and at the very end of the game, shoots two over Craig Elo, goes in, and you probably have seen the celebration by Michael Jordan on the court many, many times. Yeah, that was against Cleveland. That's called the shot. And so there's the fumble and the shot and the drive, and pretty soon the town begins to get irritated by this. And all the Cleveland jokes, and it's a very sports-oriented city, and they get you right to the edge, and then they let you down. And so LeBron James is from Akron. Akron is about 45 miles southeast or so of Cleveland. And for LeBron James to excel, to get drafted by Cleveland, which was also very fluky, stay for several years, get the Cleveland Cavaliers in a couple title games. They lost them both, of course. And then he moves to Miami, wins two titles with the Heat. And even though there was a pretty severe divorce between the town and Cleveland, he comes back to Cleveland 2 years ago, promising to win, loses last year, has a rematch against the same team this time, and this time in seven games, as I predicted, Cleveland wins.
Coming up.
The most popular television show in the 1950s was I Love Lucy, and its peak year, it averaged a 70 share rating, meaning 70% of active television sets in the country were tuned to this one show at one time. The most popular show now, putting aside special events, gets something like a 14 share.
Fragmented media may tell us a lot about a people when the Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Listening as I did to many candidates who shared the podium at the many GOP debates, Yuval Levin's recent book, The Fractured Republic, makes a lot of sense to me. Levin, the founding editor of National Affairs, has been a keen observer of cultural changes in our country and understands well the long view of the American story. Levin explained his thesis as a recent guest of my colleague, Michael Medved.
Your book has a brilliant insight, which I had not come across before. The point that you make, not to oversimplify, seems to be that liberals are nostalgic for one aspect of the American past, and conservatives are nostalgic for a completely different aspect of the American past. How would you define the difference?
It's really striking when you listen to our politicians now talk about the challenges we have. So much of the conversation is really about a kind of bygone America where liberals tend to talk about how easy it might have been to get a job and keep it for life and low inequality of a kind of mid-century American golden age. Conservatives tend to talk more about what has happened to the family and to the structures of our communities and of our and the moral consensus that wants to find our society. These things are worth missing. It's not that it's crazy to think in this way about politics. What you find is that a lot of the times the left is basically arguing for a kind of return to the economic arrangements of, at best, the mid-1960s, really, before deregulation and the greater market orientation of the economy. Conservatives are arguing, in one sense, for a rerunning of the 1980s, in another sense, for a kind of return to 1950s families. And over, we find ourselves confronted with elections that present to the public a choice between 1965 and 1981, and the public finds that rightfully frustrating. It doesn't speak to contemporary problems in contemporary terms. There's a lot to learn from what we're nostalgic for, but we also have to understand the ways that America has changed and what that should mean for how we now approach the country. But it seems to me that conservatives in general, in thinking about how we might translate the enduring principles we bring to the table to deal with contemporary problems, have especially to think about decentralization and subsidiarity, because the big way that our country has changed from those years that we so long for in our politics is that a consolidated society that we had in the middle of the 20th century has fragmented and fractured. There are good things about this. We have a more diverse society. We have a more dynamic economy. We have a lot more options and choices in every realm of our lives. But we also have less order and less structure. We have less security and less stability. And the challenge we face is how to use the very fact of our fracture and fragmentation to address the problems that it creates. And so how does this diverse, dynamic society deal with the challenges of fragmentation and insecurity and instability. I think the core of the answer is that public policy needs to look more like the country, which means it needs to function more from the bottom up. It needs to be much more decentralized, much more based on the premise that we solve problems by empowering problem solvers throughout our country, rather than by hoping that one in Washington is going to get things right.
One of the things that we really ought to celebrate in this campaign, that very few Americans do celebrate, is people are turning to a far greater variety of news sources for their information. But you argue that's not entirely positive.
Yeah. Well, it's absolutely right, and there's a lot about it that is enormously positive, of course, and it allows us, for one thing, to kind of break the stranglehold of certain kinds of elite liberal assumptions that control the mainstream media. But it does also mean that our country has fewer common mass experiences. We have less of a common culture than we used to. It's really striking how much has changed on that front. You'll know this better than anyone, but in looking at this for the book, the most popular television show in the 1950s was I Love Lucy, and its peak year, it averaged a 70 share rating, meaning 70% of active television sets in the country were tuned to this one show at one time. The most popular show now, putting aside special events, gets something like a 14 share. So our country doesn't have nearly as much of a common popular culture as it used to. And in that sense, doesn't have nearly as much in common. One thing that means is that by having a lot more choice, by having a lot more control over what we're exposed to, we do tend to isolate ourselves and lock ourselves up in certain kinds of echo chambers where we only hear things we want to hear. And it does become very difficult to break out of certain kinds of familiar and comfortable assumptions. And that doesn't just mean that we don't hear from people we disagree with. It means we don't even rethink in our own terms, based on our own premises and principles, some of the assumptions that guide us. And so you find the Republican Party, for instance, locked into a kind of 1980s agenda, some of which is very applicable to today and some of which really isn't very applicable, and failing to confront contemporary problems, in part because the kind of media echo chamber that we all live in just reinforces what we already think rather than forcing us to confront realities that have to be dealt with.
Coming up.
The United States, I think, is still the most free place in terms of religious liberty. And despite all of the challenges that we have, we do still have a First Amendment.
Russell Moore still has reason to be optimistic. The Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. We are coming off a several-week period when it's been difficult to be optimistic, in any sense, about what's taking place in our beloved republic. And now, the source of terrorism is spreading across the world and strikes even in beloved Orlando. The presidential nominee, the mess that's been delivered to us by the current administration, this horrific Islamist terrorism, well, just wow. Still, looking at the historical record and observing conditions worldwide, we really ought to be grateful, believe it or not, and optimistic, believe it or not. I was reminded of this in a way when I interviewed Dr. Russell Moore, the theologian, professor, preacher, and now the head of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention. Moore and I were both part of a recent event of the Alliance Defending Freedom, a religious liberty summit. Here's some of the highlights of our discussion on the Hugh Hewitt Show. So now I asked Alan Sears if he is despairing, because there are a lot of people who are driving to work right now.
Right.
And they're all over the United States, and it's 7:30 in the morning in D.C., and they're going to work, and they're putting one foot ahead of the other, and they're despairing. They think we've lost. Justice Scalia left us at the wrong time. The Lord called him at the wrong time. What do you say?
I'm really not despairing. And what part of that is, I mean, I have a long-term optimism, obviously, as a Christian, but I have a short-term optimism, too, because I really do think that the sexual revolution and all of the things that we see going on, it's not sustainable. And so I do think we have a lot of people who are going to be asking, is there a different way from the way that we've been going? And so we have to be the kind of people who know answers to those questions. But you know, there are no permanent revolutions in this country at all. And so we're going to have a back and forth. And we just need to be the people who are. I think that when people do start to despair, then they tip over into outrage and meanness. Because they think something's being taken away from them. And I really don't think that's the case.
In fact, we saw cruelty surface, embody itself in the assassination of a very good woman who was aiding Syrian refugees in Great Britain. And I talked with Andrew Roberts One nut, one fanatic has changed the course of history again. And a man tried to kill Trump in Las Vegas. And so we do see there is this unmistakable murmuring of violence online that is amplified. What do you tell your pastors about this?
Well, I mean, we can see that in any era in history. And I think right now there's a time when we're at a time when politics, particularly globally speaking, has become a religion. And that lends itself to violent behavior. And so I think one of the things we have to do is to give a vision of life in which politics is not ultimate, and public policy is not ultimate. Because when that's the case, when people find their entire identity in these things, it leads to some really horrific, horrific action.
My old friend Andrew Breitbart used to say culture is upstream of politics. And I always believed that faith was upstream of culture. But it does seem like that's bollocksed up now, that everything is politicized and brutal. I mean, there isn't any kind of conversation that occurs. So how are you counseling the church in America to engage in a culture that is really, it's not even hostile, it's antithetical to it?
Well, the way we're doing it is by starting with Sunday school, children's Sunday school, and talking about teaching children what it means to have a greater identity than the identities that the culture would claim for them from the very beginning. What does it mean to be part of the people of God? What does it mean then to trust in sovereignty of God, to love people who disagree with us? And you really just you shouldn't start when people are in the middle of things in their 40s and 50s. We need to start at the very beginning.
That's radical. Be hard to get people to do it. I remember your dissertation sort of echoed Dallas Willard about talking about the kingdom. And you do begin with the children. But isn't do people have the patience to do that? Are you, I mean, is it actually growing and flourishing?
Yeah, absolutely. Because one of the problems we have is that we have an entire generation of evangelicals, theologically informed, gospel-rooted, gospel-centered, and they have a tendency to want to overreact to the mistakes of the last generation. And I agree with them about the mistakes of the
last year. Being too political?
Being too political, hyper-political. And sometimes they want to overreact by saying, let's just completely disengage and go back to the catacombs, which isn't going to solve it. All you do then is become just as political in a different way by baptizing the status quo. But we have to be constantly reminded of who we are, what our mission is, that we're not here accidentally. We serve a God who's in control. And that sort of message is something that evangelicals...
Yeah, I asked Alan Sears, the least free place in the world right now is the caliphate, where genocide occurs. You will be murdered if you are in any way nonconforming. What's the most free place in the world for religious liberty right now?
Well, the United States, I think, is still the most free place in terms of religious liberty. And despite all of the challenges that we have, we do still have a First Amendment. We still do have the opportunity to have a legacy of when I stand up and talk about religious freedom. I'm not just talking about something abstract. I'm talking about what the early Baptists fought for, Roger Williams and Isaac Backus, what Thomas Jefferson and James Madison stood for. And so we still have that. We have that heritage. And sometimes even when people oppose us on that, spending time talking about this really isn't everyone's interest, ultimately. You really don't want a government powerful enough to pave over consciences. That'll get you in the end.
Part of what has happened, this is a secular show. The 150 stations that are listening to me, they are not religious stations.
Right.
Christians have hesitated to proclaim the truth of what they believe.
Right.
They just don't say it.
Right?
They don't say it.
Right.
So what do you tell pastors about saying it, that Jesus is alive, he is divine, he is God? Do we do that enough in the culture?
We do not, and that's part of the problem. Well, what I find is many of the people who want to restrict religious liberty, they really aren't trying to destroy anything. Many of them just don't understand what it is to be motivated by religious conviction. So when they see the Little Sisters of the Poor, they think, well, there must really be some other motive there, power, money, or something. Part of what we have to do is just stand up and explain to our secular neighbors, this is what it means to really believe that we're going to have to give an account for our lives. And I think that's a critical component.
Russell Moore, explain that to me. I'm talking with the president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, at Dr. Moore. You should be following him on Twitter. We have to give an account for our lives. What does that mean? Because the old Catholic teaching was every day think on four things: life, death, heaven, and hell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Death, judgment, heaven, and hell. Excuse me.
Yeah. So if we really believe that we're going to have to stand at judgment and give an account for the way that we lived our lives, then that means that there's a lot at stake. for each of us. And so it's not just a matter of, sometimes our secular neighbors will say, well, why don't you just pay for the abortion-causing drugs? It's just a little bit of money. Or why won't you do this or that that the government requires you to do? We have to explain that actually does violence to our consciences. And often our secular neighbors, they do have a category for that. I mean, they know what it means to act in ways that are environmentally sustainable, for instance, and what it means to violate one's conscience when it comes to the earth. We have to explain what it means to really believe, you know, that there's this previously dead man is alive.
When you find people, do they just reject you as happily delusional and in search of community? That's what one atheist told
me.
Coming up, my conversation with Russell Moore continues in the final segment of the Town Hall Review. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. What are thinking people, serious people of faith, supposed to make of all the bad news closing in on us? In adversity, we should find opportunity. That's Russell Moore's perspective, and he's in a key position to observe this. Let's catch a few more minutes of my conversation with Russell Moore. When you find people, do they just reject you as happily delusional and in search of community? That's what one atheist told
me. I think some do, but I kind of believe as a Christian that I have intel on human nature, and I believe that every human being really is longing for ultimate and transcendent meaning. And so I have to talk to people and say, I really think you were created to know God. Now, not everybody accepts that at first, but I think people respect having an honest conversation and putting their cards on the table.
If that resonates with someone listening, what should they do?
Well, I think what they should do is to stop going in the direction they're going now and to find life in Jesus Christ, who I believe was crucified and raised from the dead and offers forgiveness of sin.
Practical. Yellow pages. What do they do?
Well, find a good gospel preaching church.
And you ask a friend, right?
Yeah.
Someone whose life
someone
you want to model.
Yeah.
Right. That's what I've always told people. Just find the nicest person, you know, who goes to church and the most compassionate and the most winsome. Not always the nicest. But someone who knows what they believe and ask them what they do and see if you can tag along. They won't say no, right?
No, they won't. No, they won't.
So, Russell Moore, what do you want out of politics in this most unusual season? You've been outspoken. I know what you believe. This isn't a political show. It's a religious liberty show. But what do you want the dialogue to be like for the next 5 months?
I really just want to get through the next 5 months.
Amen.
I'm more concerned about 2017 than I am right now about 2016 and what we do to rebuild after this crazy election year.
What do you put this down to? Neither party has nominated either person about whom the party is excited. So yeah. What happened? The collapse of America. If I was going to write a book, I'd call it The Collapse.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we all I think the entire primary season was about expressing emotions that had nothing to do with electing an actual president.
You're a smart guy. Can I try my theory on you?
Yeah.
9/11, terribly traumatic event. The panic of 2008, 2007, another traumatic event. The entire country is suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, and they're acting out. What do you think?
I think that's quite likely. Yeah. And I think we're at a point now where there are many people who are starting to sort of like someone who is experiencing PTSD, starting to panic and saying, wait a minute, what are we doing? Where is this actually going to go? And so 2017, we're going to have to do a lot of cultural and political rebuild.
Are you confident of the church?
I am confident of the church. I'm more optimistic about the church than I have ever been.
Really?
Yeah. Younger people in churches are far better than anything I've ever seen. They know what they believe. They're committed to it. They're ready to give their lives to it. And I'm very hopeful about that.
Russ, thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review. Tell a friend, sign up for a podcast or a program at townhallreview.com. And be sure to follow us now on Twitter at Town Hall Review. That's at Town Hall Review. For executive producer Russell Schubin, producers Charlie Richard, Derek Fowler, and Dwayne Patterson, I'm Hugh Hewitt. Join us again next week for another edition of Town Hall Review, the weekend review program from a perspective you can trust.